All right, if you would like to open up your Bible to 1 Samuel, we are in chapter 5, and we're going to cover three chapters, and I'm actually going to read because usually I don't read and I just talk and I ask you to kind of look on to the text, but tonight I'm going to read this, part of this at least, and I'll tell you basically what it's about, just as if you haven't already read. So if you remember, Eli and his sons and the Philistines having victory over the Israelites because of the sin of Eli's sons and because of the sin of Eli, you'll remember that Eli died, his sons died, the ark was captured, and basically Shiloh was destroyed. When I say it was destroyed, it's a really interesting thing. You can see as you read this passage that this must be an inspired writer here. Because if a person was just writing an account of what would take place, and we think that Samuel is probably the one who's writing at least at this point, although he won't be the writer later on. This is an accumulation of different writers, 1 and 2 Samuel here, different accounts. In chapter 5, after everything that had happened in chapters 3 and 4, a human individual would have, if he wanted to talk about what had happened, would probably be crying and lamenting and be frustrated with what had happened to Shiloh. But Shiloh was the place of the tabernacle of God and where the ark had been. And we know from reading other parts of the Old Testament that basically they ransacked it. And they killed a majority of the priests, not just Eli's sons. And they captured the Ark of the Covenant. So they basically, the Philistines destroyed Israel's worship center. And we understand about Israel that the center of their life was where their worship center was. I mean, later on in Jerusalem was, if you will, the capital or the Mecca, if you will, of their life, of their existence. So for what happened in Shiloh, it really knocked Israel back a great deal. And nothing is said about that, but simply what we get to talk about is what happened to the Philistines because they take the Ark of God. Now, it was a customary thing in those times that the winner of the war took the spoils. And if there were idols or if there was something that represented the god of the people that had been defeated, it would usually be put on display. Kind of like saying the gods are with us and not with your gods, and now we're going to make a mockery of your people. We're going to celebrate our victory over you. And so what the Philistines are going to do is they're going to take this ark, which represents God, Jehovah, and they're going to bring it into their temple and place it at the feet of Dagon. And Dagon was the Philistine idol. He was the father of Baal. He's known as the corn god or the fish god. There's some different ideas about his origin. But if you think about their blessings, their crops, whatever it was that represented who they were as a people, Dagon was kind of the god that they worshiped above all other gods. And so some interesting things happen here. And what's going to happen is God is going to prove to the Philistines that just because they have his ark doesn't mean that they're in charge. So let's look here in chapter 5. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And Ashdod was about 35 miles west of Jerusalem, but getting close to the Mediterranean Sea. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon, fallen on his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set it up in its place again. Some commentators here say that the reason why they had gathered in the morning was perhaps they were going to have some type of ceremony and kind of celebrate that they had taken the ark of God. And when they got there in the morning, here is Dagon, their god, on his face. So they prop him back up again. Verse 4. And when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon, fallen on its face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were broken off at the threshold. Only the torso of Dagon was left of it. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor any who come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. But the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod, and he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how it was, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is harsh toward us and Dagon our God." Therefore they sent and gathered to themselves all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be carried away to Gath." So they carried the ark of God of Israel away. And so it was that after they had carried it away, that the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great destruction. And he struck the men of the city, both small and great, and tumors broke out on them. Therefore they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So it was, as the ark of God came to Ekron, that the Ekronites cried out, saying, "They have brought the ark of God of Israel to us to kill us and our people." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel, and let it go back to its own place, so that it does not kill us and our people." For there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were stricken with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So we see what's happening here. Everywhere the ark of God goes, it wreaks havoc among the Philistines, and people are dying. When it says there in verse 11, "Send away the ark of God and let it go back to its own place," they're surely not talking about Shiloh, because Shiloh doesn't exist anymore. They're simply saying, "Give it back to the Israelites. We're done with it, because it is wrecking our life. It is killing our people." It was no good thing when it was being shipped off to another city. The new city didn't want to see it. So I read some more, of course, about this background in different commentaries, and most commentators believe that what the plague that was striking the people, the tumors and the plague, was similar to what in the 14th century happened in Europe with bubonic plague. And it was carried by rats, you may remember. And the fleas that bit the rats bit the people, and they killed really a large, almost the majority of Europe at that time with this terrible plague. And you'll see here in a few moments that they're trying to come up with some kind of solution to give the Ark of God back to the Israelites. And there's going to be involved in that golden tumors and golden rats. That sounds strange, but what this is going to be is an offering. An offering along with the shipping of the Ark of God back to the Israelites. But there's some recognition here from the Philistines that the God of Israel is in charge of what's happening here. Just like the Egyptians dealt with the plagues, so now the Philistines are dealing with the plagues that are coming from Jehovah. So stop just for a minute, and I want to ask you this question. If you're the Philistines, and this is happening to you, and you worship Dagon, and you worship Baal and Ashtoreth, the female version of Baal, his wife, I guess that would be, and then there's Jehovah, the God of the Israelites, and this ark. And obviously, the power that's coming from this ark that is devastating your people. What would you think would be the natural reaction? I mean, at least if it were you. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I'm thinking. They're just shipping off the ark. How about if they would bow to Jehovah? How about if they would maybe submit to him? Yeah, right. It's this kind of a funny picture that we see, is that they think that they're in charge and that the God of Israel is going to bow to Dagon, but here's this Philistine God with its face on the ground in front of the Ark of God. Who is the only God that's going to be worshipped? It's obviously Jehovah. But the Philistines don't do that. They simply ship it off. I think that's interesting. Don't you think that if you have been doing something for centuries, and it's a part of your culture, and it's ingrained in your life, that to give something up like that that would be a difficult thing to do, obviously. And don't you think that one of the reasons why you and I struggle, and the rest of the world struggles with holding on to our traditions, is because they are so ingrained in us that maybe new revelations may not be accepted if our heart is not right. So our heart always has to be open to new information. And for me, this is information, some pretty significant information, that Dagon is not a god that can overcome Jehovah. And yet the people don't respond in that way. Instead, they just, they just say, we need to get away from this. Do you remember when Jesus was, I think it says he was in the region of the Gadarenes at the time, or the Gergesenes, it says, some versions say. But do you remember when he cast that legion into the swine? Do you remember that? And the swine went mad, and they ran over a cliff into the water, and they drowned. And do you remember what the reaction of the people was to what Jesus had done there? Do you remember? They said, you need to leave here. We don't want you around. They didn't say, you must be the Messiah. They didn't say, who are you that you could cast this demon into these swine? They just sent him away. They couldn't deal with it. They couldn't deal with what he had done. Maybe they were angry because some people had lost their prized pigs. But I just think it's interesting how sometimes people react to something like that. Okay, let's go on to chapter 6. So the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, and the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners. This is, of course, their priests. What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place. So they said, if you send away the ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it to him with a trespass offering. Then you'll be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Then they said, what is the trespass offering which we shall return to him? They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and all of your lords. So representing these 5 cities that were basically run by these 5 particular men, we have 5 golden tumors because of the tumors and 5 rats because we believe that's the way the disease was being spread among the people. And it says that the rats were rampant there. Verse 5, therefore you shall make images of your tumors and images of your rats that ravage the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods, and from your land. Why then did you harden your hearts, as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts, when he did mighty things among them? Did they not let the people go, that they might depart? Now therefore make a new cart, take 2 milk cows which have never been yoked, and hitch the cows to the cart, to take their calves home away from them. Then take the ark of the Lord and set it on the cart, and put the articles of God which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side, and send it away and let it go. And watch. If it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us great evil, this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us, but it was just by chance that it happened to us. Okay, so they're trying to determine whether or not this really is the hand of Jehovah, or if it's just a disease. And so they said, let's give the ark back. I mean, obviously it wasn't a coincidence, because every time the ark went into a town, everybody died. Okay. They put it on a cart. They get the golden offerings ready. And they say, we're going to aim them towards Beth Shemesh, and we'll just see what happens. And if they just march right into the country of Israel, then we know that this is being accepted by God. Verse 10. Then the men did so. They took 2 milk cows, hitched them to the cart, shut up their calves at home, and they set the ark of the Lord on the cart and the chest with the gold rats and the gold images and images of their tumors. I don't know what that looked like, but don't you want to know what a golden tumor looked like? Maybe you don't want to know what a golden tumor looked like. Then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right hand or the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they lifted their eyes and saw the ark and rejoiced to see it. Then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there. So they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the chest that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on the large stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices. the same day to the Lord. So when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron the same day. Now, these are the gold tumors which the Philistines returned as a trespass offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, and one for Ekron. And the gold rats, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines, belonged to the five lords, both fortified cities and country villages, even as far as the large stone of Abel on which they set the ark of the Lord, which stone remains to this day in the field of Joshua, Beth Shemesh. Now look at this in verse 19. God is no respecter of persons. Then he, that is God, struck the men of Beth Shemesh, because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck 50,070 men of the people, and the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before his holy Lord God, and to whom shall it go up from us?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up with you." Verse 19, the Israelites don't respect it either. And they decide to open it up and look inside, and how many people died? Maybe that was inspiration of Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you saw that movie. Don't open the Ark of the Covenant and look inside. I remember watching that when I was a kid, and the way that those guys' faces melted. I'd never seen anything like that on TV before in a movie. But, you know, there's an idea there that you don't disrespect the power of God. And so God is no respecter of persons here. People, when the people sinned with the Ark, whether they were Israelites or if they were foreigners, God disciplined all of them. Here's my next question. Based on everything that you've read to this point, if the ark had come to you, what would you do? Huh? Call the Levites. What would you do? If the Ark of the Covenant had come to you, what would you do? Would you not be very careful at this point? Would you not be, after everything that you had seen, realize that your very life was in the hands of God and that you need to be very careful with what you did with this, what God considered very holy? I mean, this was where the presence of God, it says, dwelt between the cherubim, where those wings touched the presence of God, and that's where that blood was sprinkled by the high priest on the Day of Atonement to atone for the sins of the people. And God said all the time that he was with Israel, that his presence dwelt above the Ark of the Covenant there. That's where his mercy was poured out upon the people. And we recognize also the veil. What did the veil represent? The veil of the temple between the holy place and the most holy place. Why was that veil there? Why was there separation? Because of sin. We just went through the book of Hebrews, you remember. And you remember what the Hebrew writer said about the sacrifice of the high priests? That he would go up every year, and it was a what? What was it? His offering was a what? I know this is kind of a very open statement, and unless you know exactly where I'm in the text, this is kind of like a roll of the dice for you to answer this question. It was an atonement, but what did it represent to the people with regard to what God was remembering or not? It was a reminder. Okay, he said that the offering was a reminder that the people were separated from God. But when he was done with that atonement sacrifice, where did he go? He left the ark, didn't he? And he went on back on the other side of the curtain, and he stayed on the other side of that curtain for how long? 364 days. The point is this: the holiness of God and the sin of man cannot coexist. Think about that again. The holiness of God and the sin of man cannot coexist. That being the case, what position are we in when we sin? Think about that. And I want you to think about that even with regard to just daily living. What does it say about our body in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 that it is a what? It's chapter 6. Your body, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, whom you have from God? And you were not your own, for you were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are God's. Who's the temple now? In the Old Testament, you see the temple, and the presence of God dwells in the holy place, the most holy place. Consider what Paul is saying there in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. He's now saying, your body is the temple. And now God dwells in you. Isn't that amazing? You think about how vile and sinful we are, and how, you know, we're fleshly creatures, we're carnal people. We struggle with temptation every day, and yet God is willing to say that I am going to dwell inside of you. There's power in the blood, isn't there? That could make union possible between sinful man and a holy God. Go ahead. Okay, good. I like that. That sounds like something that I've heard you preach before. Yeah, you know, we are the people for his temple. He allows us to be the temple. And that's remarkable. But we're looking at the Ark of the Covenant. And the point that I'm trying to make out of all this is that it was not to be disrespected. Didn't matter if it was an Israelite. Didn't matter if it was a Gentile. God was going to prove that he was sovereign and that he was going to be honored. He was going to be respected. And the Ark of the Covenant was a symbol, was it not? Give me a symbol of the New Testament church. Give me a symbol. I think the church itself is a symbol, if you really want to know about it. It's a symbol of where God dwells, and it's a symbol of his people. Do you think that God is going to have any different opinion about people who are irresponsible with his church? I don't think so. Do you think that God is going to have any different opinion now than he did then with people that don't regard the holiness of the communion or the holiness of worship or maybe the name of his son and how he's represented? Even though God does not strike people with tumors today, and even though God doesn't wipe out 50,070 in a day, do you think that God is not paying attention? I think what we understand is that because of the way that the church is structured, and because now we're in the law of liberty, perfect law of liberty, a law of faith, and that it's not a physical law, and we don't see God reacting to discipline in physical ways, I think we realize that the judgment scene is that time. But that God is taking all these things into account, and he's going to reward those who obey him, and he's going to discipline those and cut off those who disobey him. So I think it's an important thing to remember. This is the same God. God hasn't changed. The same God that struck these people with these tumors and these plagues, same God. And I think that this paints a picture to us about what it says in Romans chapter 11, behold the goodness and the severity of God. On those who are righteous, he shows goodness. On those who are disobedient, he's going to be severe. Okay, so chapter 7. We're going to see the return of the ark. You know, there's a fellow here in chapter 7, I believe it's mentioned here, who they bring it to. And it lives, the ark of God lives in one place for 20 years. So let's look at it. The men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab. There it is. I don't know who Abinadab was. Never met the fellow. But he was able to keep the ark of God in his house for 20 years. Where just by people looking at it, one day, looking inside of it, 50,000 people died. He must have been doing something right. So, kudos to Abinadab. And consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. So it was that the ark remained in Kirjath-Jearim a long time. It was there 20 years. And the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. What do you think that means, that the Israelites lamented after the Lord? Someone else have a different thing in their different version? What do you got there? Yeah, Lamentations. I mean, think about the book of Lamentations. What Jeremiah is crying, isn't he? He's crying because of the sin of Israel and because of the discipline of God that has to come upon an unfaithful people. They missed their relationship with God that they lost when the ark was taken. And it was not, you know, eventually David moves it. We're going to get to that. And, you know, he moves it incorrectly the first time, and Uzzah dies and all of that. And then he moves it correctly the second time when he obeys the commandment of God. Eventually, it's placed in Solomon's temple. And after that, in 586 B.C., when Judah is taken captive, it disappears. And we don't know anything that happened to it specifically after that. It disappears from the scene. But it was a representation of the relationship of the Israelites and God. And I think what they realized was that they were out of place. Their relationship with God was not what it should be. And they mourned. They mourned their mistakes. And they mourned the fact that there was no tabernacle, there was no temple for the ark of God to dwell in. Okay, verse 3. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, "If you return to the Lord with all your hearts, and put away the foreign gods and the Asherahs from among you, and prepare your hearts for the Lord, and serve him only, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines." Okay, and it says in verse 4 that they put them away. So what is that telling us that happened to the Israelites when they went into the Canaan land? What did they become? We know this already. They became idol worshippers. And what were they worshipping? What kind of gods were they worshipping? The gods of who? The Philistines. They were worshipping the gods of their enemies. How does that happen? I want to ask you that. Come on, let's think about it. How is it possible that you leave God for another god? You leave truth for something that's not truth, but it's still religion. How does that happen? How did Solomon leave it? Married all these foreign wives. One of the commandments to the children of Israel when they came into the Canaan land was to not intermarry with the Canaanites. Why? Because he said they will turn your heart away from God. Is who we decide to marry significant? Does it influence the way that we think? The way that we behave? Yeah. So, do we not think about those of us that have, okay, I've got three kids, you know that. None of them have paired off yet, all right? I wonder who they're going to marry. And I wonder how that's going to go. You know, it's really probably not fair, but I don't necessarily hate my daughters-in-law, but I'd already kind of hate my son-in-law. That's probably not fair. I mean, that's the way I guarantee that's the way that Amber's dad looked at me at the beginning. He did not like me at all. He's coming around. Still sometimes, you know. But we recognize how important marriage is. And I believe that a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were intermarrying. And they were taking the wives or the men were bringing these Canaanite gods that were a part of their heritage. They were bringing them to their home. So when a couple decides to get married, and there's a union between, say, a person who's a child of God and a person who is not, that If they're going to enter into that, then that Christian person needs to understand how difficult that is going to be versus having the same values and the same beliefs and the same worship, the same, that they need to understand how difficult that's going to be. Now, usually we'll say, well, we love each other. Everyone's going to be okay. You know, give them 5 years, you know, and see how that goes. You know, you don't just marry a person, you marry their whole family, right? And the traditions and the ideas and the in-laws and the outlaws and the cousins, but all of those things, you bring those things, even the way that they do things, even how they do holidays. How many times have you argued over the holidays with your spouse, how you're going to handle that when that time comes around? And the point that I'm trying to make here is that the people that we decide to make covenants with, they're going to influence the way that we think. And what I want to say to myself is, surely the Israelites were not so unintelligent that they would leave Jehovah God, who brought them out of the land of Israel, out of Egypt, with these... I mean, even the Philistines were like, don't mess with Jehovah. And yet the Israelites were willing to disregard him and follow these other gods. And sometimes that's hard for me to conceptualize. But how many things do we give up? And how many things do we walk away from as we move along life's pathway that at one time were a big part of our relationship with God? How dedicated are we to the covenants that we decided to make as we were younger? And then as the world begins to influence us, how often do we begin to compromise those things? I think we do that often, if we'd be honest with ourselves. It could be something as simple as what we decide to watch on television, or the type of language we decide to use, or what type of company we keep based on the type of lifestyle some of these people live. I mean, we do compromise sometimes. And we just need to be aware of those things, that they don't affect us. Can you go back 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and say that you are drawing yourself closer to the Lord as you are surrounded by the world, or are you slowly walking away from Him? I think you have to be on guard for those things. Let's keep going. So they put him away, and Samuel says, gather everyone together, and I'm going to pray for you. And they gathered at Mizpah, they drew water out, they fasted, they have admitted their sin, and Samuel began to judge the people of Israel. Now, when the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid. So the children of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry to the Lord God for us, that he may serve us from the hand of the Philistines. Why are they afraid? Because the last time they had battle, they died. They got crushed. And they don't want to go up against the Philistines again, and they knew they had sinned. And what did they recognize? They began to recognize that victory was not possible without God. In fact, it was absolutely going to be defeat if they were not spiritually ready and giving God the credit for what was going on. So Samuel took a suckling lamb, offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. And Samuel offered up the burnt offering. The Philistines drew near to battle against Israel, but the Lord thundered with a loud thunder upon the Philistines that day, and so confused them that they were overcome before Israel. And the men of Israel went out to Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and drove them back as far as below Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Ebenezer. Now you can go back to Joshua and remember that stone that he set up. But the word means, thus far the Lord has helped us, or it means stone of help. Here I raise my Ebenezer. Hither by thy help I have come, and I hope by thy good measure safely to arrive at home. That's the song. And all that is saying is, so far God has led me. I recognize that in life it is God that has delivered me, and I pray that he will continue to deliver me. That's the representation of that word in that song. That's what we're singing. God's in our life. He's delivered us from sin, and we believe that by his good grace, one day we'll be in heaven with him. That's the song we're asking him to complete the victory in us. So the Philistines were subdued. They did not come anymore to the territory of Israel, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines as all the days of Samuel. So we'll stop there. Samuel begins to judge the people, judges them all the days of his life, verse 15. And Ramah was his home, but he judged in all these different cities there in verse 16. Chapter 8, we're going to get in next week, chapter 8 and 9 and so on, we're going to get into the people rejecting Samuel, rejecting his sons as leaders, calling for a king, and Saul being selected as the first king of Israel.